Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. All right, welcome back. We hope you survived our spooky season double feature. And now that the Halloween thrills are behind us, we have 9 episodes left of 2025. Mm. Yep, can you believe that?
I know, this year's gone by so fast.
I know, God. So for the rest of this year, I'm going to pull back from the true crime world some. For the most part, each of these cases have a true crime sense, with a couple being all in. But I thought, let's end the year on a mixture of cases from deep and heavy to mysterious, and then ending with unsolved.
Nice.
Then in 2026, we're going to start new, diving deep into the true crime world once again. So now for today's episode, it's the first one of November. And today, we're going to peel back the mask of true horror. The kind that thrives not in haunted houses, but behind the closed doors of a seemingly perfect home. And today's story isn't about monsters in the dark, but instead, it's about the monster wearing a tie at the breakfast table. So, if you're ready.
I'm ready whenever you are, honey.
All right. Our story begins in a place that, on the surface, represented the height of the American dream. Westfield, New Jersey. In the early 1970s, Westfield was a picturesque, affluent suburb known for its historic mansions and tree-lined streets. Our focus today is on one of its grandest homes, a sprawling 19-room Victorian residence at 43 Hillside Avenue, nicknamed Breeze Knoll. This was the home of the List family. The patriarch was John Emil List, born in 1925. The seemingly ordinary, meticulous man. He was a veteran of both World War II and the Korean War. He was a trained accountant and, critically, a man of deep, unwavering Lutheran faith. So devout that he taught Sunday school and also served as a Boy Scout troop leader. List was known as a strict disciplinarian who insisted his children follow extremely rigid rules. John List was raised with an extremely rigid moral code. A man's worth was tied directly to his ability to be a successful, self-sufficient provider for his family. In his family, there was his wife, Helen, who was 47, John's mother, Alma, who was at a stately 85 years old, who lived in a separate apartment in the attic, and their 3 children, Patricia, who was 16, a reserved and bright girl who was interested in theater and wore the popular long hair and makeup of the era. Frederick, who was 13, a typical energetic boy, and then there was John Jr., who was 15, a high school student with aspirations of being a musician. To the neighbors and their congregation, the List were the definition of respectable, conservative, and God-fearing. If you passed him on the street, you wouldn't have noticed him. Clean-cut, polite, a man who held doors and attended church every Sunday. But behind that calm exterior was something far more dangerous, a storm of pride. Faith, and quiet madness. This isn't the story of a man who snapped. It's the story of a man who planned. But scratch beneath the surface of the granite veneer and you find deep, rotting cracks. By 1971, John List's life was a carefully constructed lie. Despite the 19 rooms, the ballroom, and the manicured lawn, the Lists were teetering on the edge of financial ruin. John List had been secretly unemployed for months. He had lost his job as an accountant at a Jersey City bank, and every attempt to find a new position had failed. He was so paralyzed by the shame of his failure, so terrified of admitting he could no longer be the breadwinner, that he went to extraordinary lengths to hide it. Every day, he would dress in his suit and tie, kiss his family goodbye, and drive to the train station. only to spend his day reading newspapers or sitting in the library.
Sounds like just an old, ordinary man.
Yeah. So the family situation was compounded by the fact that the magnificent Breeze Knoll was originally owned by Alma, who was John's mother. She had sold it to him. Alma technically still held the deed and was supposed to be receiving regular payments from her son. But obviously she wasn't. The mortgage on Breeze Knoll was in default, and John List, having failed to uphold his patriarchal duty, was secretly draining his elderly mother Alma's savings to try to keep up with the payments. For John List, a man whose entire moral and religious framework rested on the pillar of success and self-sufficiency, his failure wasn't just financial. It was a moral, spiritual catastrophe. The truth was, the financial stress was just one half of the burden John List was carrying. His marriage was deeply troubled by a secret his wife Helen had kept for years. Helen List was an alcoholic and had been increasingly unstable. More shockingly, List discovered that Helen had contracted tertiary syphilis from her first husband, a condition she had hidden from John their entire 18-year marriage.
Damn.
She had insisted they marry in a state that did not require the premarital syphilis test, which I did not know was a thing.
Back then it was.
Yeah, I had no idea that was a thing.
Now, I mean, they don't even, most places don't require blood tests anymore.
No.
And that's what that was.
I found that shocking because I did not know that was a thing.
Yeah.
So this untreated disease coupled with her alcoholism contributed to her progressively deteriorating health. To John, the rigidly moral man, this was not just a medical issue. It was a profound spiritual defilement that intensified his sense of shame and failure to protect his family's honor and salvation. He was sinking under the weight of financial ruin, spiritual fear, and spousal deception. In his mind, his only way out was to protect his family from the shame and the potential moral decay that he believed came with poverty. He saw the free spirit in the 1970s and his children's burgeoning independence, like Patricia's interest in acting, as spiritual threats. He wrote that his greatest fear was that they would stray from the church and lose their souls. List's twisted ultimate conclusion, rooted in his fundamentalist beliefs, was this: suicide was a mortal sin that would condemn him to hell. But if he killed his family, he could save their souls and ensure their place in heaven. Then perhaps he could confess his sin later and receive forgiveness. John List wasn't alone in this pathology. Criminologists later classified his type of crime under the chilling term family annihilator. These are individuals who are usually men who kill their entire families in response to perceived personal failure. Often they are perfectionists, deeply religious, and unable to face the collapse of the image they've built for themselves. For John List, that image was the perfect Christian patriarch. The moment it cracked, he decided everyone had to go with it. The only way out, John List decided, was to meticulously, methodically, annihilate his entire family using his own 9mm handgun and the .22 caliber revolver that belonged to his late father. On the morning of Tuesday, November 9th, 1971, began like any other in Breeze Knoll. But the man of the house had a schedule to keep, and it was a schedule of murder. His first action was to ensure he had time. Before the sun was up, John List meticulously went through his daily routines of deception. He canceled the delivery of milk, the mail, and the newspapers. He also went to the extra calculated effort of writing notes to his children's school and their part-time jobs, claiming the family was suddenly called away to visit an ailing maternal grandmother in North Carolina. These small planned actions were designed to buy him weeks of unaccounted time before anyone noticed the family was missing. He waited until two of his children, Frederick and Patricia, had left for school. List then retrieved his weapon, a 9mm Steyr semi-automatic handgun, and his father's old .22 caliber Colt revolver. His first victim was his wife, Helen List. He shot her in the back of the head with the 9mm while she was in the kitchen, reportedly as she was drinking coffee. I bet you'll never look at coffee the same again.
It's like, man, let me at least have my coffee first.
Immediately following this, he went upstairs to the attic apartment and shot his mother on the list above the left eye while she was still in bed, using the .22 caliber revolver that belonged to his father.
What? So far, he seems like a real, he's wound too tight.
Yeah. Little too tight.
He needs to loosen that tie up. He's choking himself.
Right. With the silence of the large house settling in, Liss was now in a holding pattern, waiting for his children to return home from school. They ate lunch in the kitchen, surrounded by the silence his own actions had created.
When That's Frederick, creepy. I'm just...
Right. I'm just going to chill here in the house with my dead wife and mom. Eat me some lunch. Like nothing just happened. Fucking weirdo. When Frederick, his 13-year-old son, came home, Liss shot him immediately in the back of the head. Moments later, his 16-year-old daughter, Patricia, arrived, and she, too, was shot in the back of her head. But Liss' schedule was not done yet. His eldest son, John Jr., was still out of the house. He had had a soccer game that day. In a chilling demonstration of detached normalcy, Liss drove to the high school to watch his son play soccer, which is not something he normally did.
There's something definitely wrong with that dude.
Yeah. So it's hard to imagine the thoughts that were going through his head as he watched his final victim running on that field. After the game, Liss drove John Jr. back to the now deadly manor. And upon entering the house, Liss shot his son repeatedly, hitting him several times in the chest and face.
Dang.
John Jr., unlike his siblings, was shot multiple times, a possible indication that he resisted or even surprised Liss. Some accounts claim that John Jr. was shot up to 10 times.
Good gravy.
Yeah. So now began the next methodical phase, the staging. First, Liss carefully cleaned up the blood from the various initial shooting spots, leaving the crime scene sterilized. He then moved the bodies of Helen and the three children into the vast ballroom of the mansion. He laid them all out neatly on sleeping bags in a straight line, almost respectively. His mother Alma remained where she had fell in her attic apartment. The house was then prepared for its long, silent wait. Liss removed all the family photographs from their frames and meticulously gathered up his own documents and bank records. He then set the thermostat low to about 55 degrees. Presumably, he did this to slow down decomposition in the days and weeks that would follow.
Man was methodical.
Mm-hmm. Because the colder it is, the longer it takes for your body to decompose.
Right.
Yeah. He also left a transistor radio on in John Jr.'s room, turned it to a religious station, and turned on the ballroom's elaborate chandelier lights. Then, in a final act of desecration against the marital wealth he had feared losing, Liss allegedly shot out the magnificent stained glass skylight in the ballroom, letting in a shaft of cold light onto the scene. On his desk, he left a 5-page letter addressed to his pastor. This confession laid bare his twisted spiritual rationale. That he had killed them to save them from what he called, quote, disgrace and ruin. He had secured their passage to heaven. His final self-serving action was to place his will near the letter, along with three $100 bills on his bed. John Liss then walked out of Breeze-Knoll, locking the immense front door behind him. Before leaving the area, he mailed the house keys and the keys to the desk containing the murder weapons to a relative. He cashed $2,000 worth of bonds, leaving him with a solid head start. He drove his car, a green 1963 Chevrolet Impala, to John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York City, where he abandoned it. And then he simply vanished. Liss was now officially a fugitive, but thanks to his meticulous planning, no one knew it. As far as the outside world was concerned, the patriarch was still diligently at work, and the family was merely on a trip. The calendar then flipped from November to December, and the great Victorian house held its dark secret. The meticulous planning of John Liss immediately paid off. The notes sent to the schools, combined with the canceled deliveries, meant that the silence of Breeze-Knoll initially aroused no suspicion. The Liss family was known to be quiet and private, many neighbors simply assumed they had gone on a trip. For nearly a month, Bree's Knoll stood silent, its grand windows staring out like empty eyes. The mail piled up, the lights burned out through the night, neighbors passed by on evening walks, their footsteps echoing against the cold air, unaware that inside those walls lay a family frozen in time. And even the house seemed to hold its breath. The illusion of a family vacation lasted for nearly a month. It was not until December 7th of 1971, almost 4 weeks after the murders, that the illusion began to crack. Neighbors who had become increasingly uneasy started to notice that the mansion was always illuminated. Since John List had left that chandelier light on in the ballroom, the house had been eerily shining for 28 consecutive days.
Damn.
More concerning was the growing foul smell emanating from the grand Victorian home. A concerned neighbor, having failed to reach anyone by phone and disturbed by the perpetual lights and odor, finally contacted the Westfield Police Department. Police forced entry into the house, and the scene they discovered was beyond horrific. They found the body of Alma List first in her attic apartment, still in her bed. The rest of the tragedy was waiting in the ballroom. There, laid out neatly side by side on sleeping bags, were the bodies of Helen, Patricia, Frederick, and John Jr. The police were immediately confronted with the full extent of John List's careful planning. The bodies were surprisingly well-preserved due to the combination of the house's size, the cool December weather, and the thermostat being set to only 55 degrees. Right. They were also instantly confronted with the motive, the 5-page letter to his pastor, found on the desk, outlining his psychotic justification for the massacre. The discovery instantly turned the List murders into a national sensation. This was a crime that shattered the suburban ideal. A devoted father, Sunday school teacher, and pillar of the community had butchered his entire family and just calmly walked away.
Cold-hearted.
Right. The confession letter named the killer and clearly explained his motive, so the police immediately knew who they were looking for. John Emil List. The initial investigation quickly established List's path of escape. The two murder weapons, the 9mm handgun and the .22 caliber revolver, were recovered at the scene. Authorities had also located his abandoned green 1963 Chevy Impala at JFK International Airport. The car's discovery led investigators to believe that List had boarded a plane and fled the country, possibly to Europe, where he had had family connections or military bases where he could live, or where he could hide. Investigators launched a nationwide manhunt, but all leads led to dead ends. John List, the meticulous accountant, had calculated every single detail. He had removed his photo from all family albums, cashed all possible bonds, and vanished into a time when surveillance technology and interstate communication were rudimentary. Crucially, John List's fingerprints were not in any national database either.
Oh, no, he wasn't a criminal before this.
Right. And despite the careful cleanup, police failed to recover any usable prints from the crime scene. So even if his prints would have been in the database, there were no prints at the scene that they could use. That is how meticulous he was about this.
Damn.
Yeah. So 9 months after the murders in August of 1972, the Bree's Knoll Mansion added another layer of mystery and devastation to the case. A massive fire erupted, almost entirely destroying the house. So while the cause of this fire was officially ruled as arson, the crime was never solved and no suspects were ever identified.
Well, we know it wasn't List because he was gone.
Right. But they never figured out who did it. Yeah. The fire wiped out the physical crime scene, including the ballroom where all of the bodies were found.
Well, I hope they got the bodies out beforehand.
Well, yeah, this was 9 months later.
Oh, 9 months. Okay, never mind. I didn't hear that part.
But they couldn't ever go back to get any more evidence because it was gone now. Yeah. So when Bree's Knoll burned in August of 1972, neighbors described the fire as eerily silent. The flames consumed the mansion from the inside out, glowing through the trees like a final act of exorcism. By dawn, only the stone foundation remained. Locals said it felt like the house itself had decided to erase the memory of what happened within its walls.
Somebody didn't like what happened.
Yeah. The loss of this iconic location only deepened the mystery and cemented the List family mansion as a notorious ghost house in New Jersey lore. With the physical evidence gone and the trail ice cold, the case of John List went into the deep freeze. Investigators spent years chasing false leads and working off the initial assumption that he was out of the country. List had achieved the impossible. He had simply disappeared. This case would remain unsolved for nearly two decades.
That's a long time.
Right. Waiting for a miraculous breakthrough that no one could have predicted. So, John List didn't flee to Europe. He just changed trains.
Damn.
After abandoning his car at JFK, he took a bus to Denver, Colorado, where he meticulously began a new life. He didn't invent a new identity entirely. He took the name Robert Peter Bob Clark, an alias he chose based on a college acquaintance.
He needs to be arrested just for the name.
The transformation was subtle but effective. List, a man who had only known life in the rigid structures of the military and church, settled into a quiet existence. He grew a mustache, wore thicker glasses, and became more stout, but his personality remained fundamentally unchanged. He was still the meticulous, soft-spoken accountant. Under the name Robert Clark, List found a job as an accountant and controller for a Denver area paper company, a role he eventually continued for other structured organizations, including military contractors, showing his continued gratification toward the world of order and defense. He joined the local Lutheran church, once again returning to the only community he had ever known. In 1985, 14 years after the murders, he even remarried.
Dude had a lot of cojones. You know?
Right. So he married a respectable woman named Dolores Miller, and she was a friend of his from church. The two settled into a quiet house in a middle-class neighborhood of Richmond, Virginia, where List continued his work as an accountant. So he left New Jersey, went to Colorado, then left there and went to Virginia. So that's where we're at now. John List had achieved the impossible. He had erased John List entirely. For nearly two decades, he successfully hid in plain sight, living a life almost identical to the one that he had destroyed, convinced that his intelligence and God's will were protecting him. Now, back in New Jersey, the case had been cold for years. The police had no photo of the older, heavier List and no useful fingerprints. Then in the late 1980s, however, investigators got an idea. They decided to use cutting-edge technology, not DNA, but a new forensic art technique to help them. They contacted Frank Bender, one of the nation's foremost forensic sculptors, known for his ability to model what a fugitive would look like decades after their disappearance.
That's wild how they can do that.
I know. I think it is the most amazing thing ever.
That's some talent, let me tell you.
Right. Bender received a package of old family photos of John List, along with psychological profiles suggesting how List would age and how his new life might affect his current appearance. Bender spent hours studying List's facial features, his Lutheran His Lutheran servitude and his need for order. Bender concluded that List would not change much, simply aging into a predictable version of himself. So basically, he's going to look the same, just older. He created a lifelike bust showing John List as a 65-year-old man with a high hairline, slightly increased weight, and crucially, a mustache. How the hell he was able to tell that he would go and grow a mustache is beyond me.
Because men just, they do when they get older.
But you get what I'm saying? Like, he had never had that before. From all accounts that I could see, he had never had a mustache before. So what would make him believe that he would grow a mustache now is crazy to me.
They just do, honey.
It's amazing how this stuff works. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know.
So it was a time when television was the new frontier for justice, okay? This was before viral videos or social media. America's Most Wanted had just begun to prove the public could help solve what police could not on their own. So that very night, millions of viewers sat in their living rooms watching the chilling clay bust of John List appear on their screens.
I saw that episode.
Oh, did you?
Yes. It was freaking wild how it looked so much like him. And when they arrested him, it's like, damn!
See, I tried to find it. I couldn't find it.
It's on, what show is it?
That show is so old now.
I'm trying to think. It's not...
And that's an old episode.
Forensic Files.
Oh.
That's where I seen it.
Oh. That's on one of our streaming things that we have. I'll have to go look on there and try to find it.
I'll tell you. Wait, hold on.
Okay. See which episode it is.
That's what I'm going to do. Season 1, episode 12.
Okay. Oh, so that really was in the early days of America's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
Okay, so anybody that wants to watch it, Forensic Files, Season 1, Episode 12. And you can watch that episode of America's Most Wanted.
I will find you all the cop shows and all the forensic shows you want. The FBI files, you name it. That's why women are better than the FBI.
I know, that's why all FBI agents should be women. I tell people that.
Because we can find out things faster than anybody.
Right, exactly. Anyway.
Especially as grandmas.
Oh, okay. So while this was going on, somewhere in Richmond, Virginia, the real man sat in his own living room, just a few miles from the woman who would call in the tip line that ended it all. So the case and Bender's new bust were chosen to be featured on the TV program America's Most Wanted. This segment, detailing the gruesome 1971 murders and showing the terrifying new image of the killer, aired on May 21st, 1989. You want to see it? Like we said, it's Forensic Files, Season 1, Episode 12. The effect was instantaneous and explosive. Within days, hundreds of tips flooded in. Most of them were useless, but one call stood out. A woman in Richmond, Virginia, had called the hotline and calmly stated that the man on TV was her neighbor, Robert Clark. She noticed the strong resemblance to the features and the mannerisms of the wanted man. Police quietly investigated this tip. They tracked Robert Clark to his workplace, took pictures, and matched his height and gait, but the final irrefutable proof was still required. On June 1st of 1989, police arrested Robert Clark at his office in Richmond, Virginia. When confronted with the name John List, the meticulous accountant initially denied it, claiming a case of mistaken identity. In fact, he maintained his denial for hours, steadfastly insisting that he was Robert Clark until he was presented with irrefutable evidence. His fingerprints, which were cross-referenced against his old military and FBI files.
That's right, because the military takes your prints.
Mm-hmm. And there was none at the crime scene for them to match it to.
Because this way, if you're killed overseas,
yep,
they have a way to figure out who the heck you are.
Yep, and they knew that it was him. But because they had no fingerprints at the scene, there was nothing for them to match. Yep, so finally, the 18-year hunt was over. The fugitive had been found, not through detective work or tracking skills, but by a TV show, a piece of clay, and a neighbor's keen eye. John List was extradited back to New Jersey to finally face justice. After 18 years of silence, the man who had annihilated his family to preserve their salvation was finally forced to confront his earthly judgment.
Well, you see, according to the Bible, the children are innocent.
Right.
So they're automatically going to go to heaven.
Yep.
The mother and the mother and the grandmother, they were religious, so they probably were saved. And they went on to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
John List is going to hell.
Right. And that was my thought process whenever I learned about this case. I'm like, but isn't murder worse than suicide, though?
Yes.
I'm like, you're reading.
Actually, you can be forgiven by God for the murder if you confess your sins.
Yeah, that's true. But you can't suicide. Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
So actually, suicide is worse.
Yeah, it is. It is.
But in today's society,
the logic behind that just makes no sense.
The logic behind why he did it.
No, it doesn't.
You know, there's pride cometh before a fall.
Yep.
And he put his pride in front of everything.
He did not love his neighbor.
Not after that, he didn't love her. Yep. And it's honor thy mother and father. So he dishonored his mother when he shot her in the head.
Right. And when it says love thy neighbor, it doesn't mean your literal neighbor. It means like the people around you.
What you put out in this world will always come back to you.
Right. That's why I said he definitely did not honor his neighbor.
In other words, karma, baby.
Right. Exactly. She's the bitch. Anyway. So in 1990, 19 years after the murders, the man known as Robert Clark stood trial in New Jersey as John List. The case was a sensation, fueled by the sheer audacity of his escape and the chilling nature of the crime. His second wife, Dolores Miller Clark, was left utterly devastated.
My heart goes out to her.
Right. She was left utterly devastated by the revelation. She testified that she had been completely fooled by Robert Clark, and their marriage was subsequently dissolved. Thank God, a poor woman.
I know it.
In court, John List looked more like an aging accountant than a murderer. He sat quietly, hands folded, answering questions with polite precision. Reporters described him as unnervingly calm, like a man discussing tax returns rather than the slaughter of his own family. It was that same calmness that chilled the nation most. Not rage, not passion, but order. List's defense team did not deny that John List had committed the murders. Instead, they pursued the only possible defense, diminished capacity.
He was a freaking nutcase.
Yep. They argued that List was suffering from severe mental illness, fueled by his extreme religious piety and the trauma of his financial and marital failures. They painted him as a man driven to a psychotic break by the crushing weight of his strict, old-world moral code, arguing that he truly believed he was saving his family's souls. All of those things could be true, but
the only one that can save their souls is God himself.
Right. So, I mean, every single one of those beliefs and all of those things that the defense claimed are true, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
He could have had a psychotic break. That is true. But there are a few things that point otherwise. The prosecution countered by focusing on the cold, calculated nature of his actions. They emphasized the meticulous planning that spanned over weeks, which goes against diminished capacity. It goes against a psychotic break. The cancellation of deliveries, the notes to the schools, the sequential timing of the murders, the careful cleanup of the crime scene, the low thermostat setting, the cash, and the abandoned car. All of those point to planned, premeditated murder, not to a psychotic break. They do not point to him not being aware of what he's doing is wrong at the time that he did it. They point to him wanting his family dead.
Divorce is so much easier.
Right. Just divorce, people. Like, you don't have to kill anybody. Just get a divorce.
Divorce and move away.
Right. Like, is it really worth it? Anyway. So the prosecution argued that these were not the actions of a man suffering from a sudden psychotic rage, but of a calculated, methodical killer executing a plan for his own selfish escape. The 5-page letter became the centerpiece of the trial, a chilling document that served not as a rambling confession of madness, but as a formal justification for murder. The jury ultimately rejected the defense of diminished capacity, and they found John List guilty on 5 counts of first-degree murder. Throughout the reading of the verdict and his subsequent sentencing, John List remained stone-faced, showing no visible emotion. The judge was unsparing, noting the methodical, military-like precision of the crime and the calculated nature of the subsequent escape. John List was sentenced to serve 5 consecutive life terms in prison, guaranteeing that he would spend the rest of his life behind bars. The judge stated that List would be ineligible for parole for nearly 125 years.
Dude's still in prison.
In the years following his conviction, John List lived out his life as an inmate in a maximum security prison. He was repeatedly asked by journalists, detectives, and reporters about his motive, and he never deviated from the twisted spiritual rationale he had laid out in his 1971 confession letter. However, in a 2002 interview with Connie Chung, List offered his final clearest statement on the killings. He expressed a chilling lack of true remorse, only regret over the circumstances. Quote, "I wish I hadn't done it, but I can't say I wish they were back alive. I really believe what I did was done to save them from what I felt was going to be an absolutely horrible life."
Kid's weird.
Yep. So it's more of it's, I don't care. Just not happy that I got caught kind of thing.
Right?
Yeah. When asked why he watched his son, John Jr., play soccer before killing him, List's answer was hauntingly simple and final. He did it to give his son one last good memory of his father.
Sick bastard.
Yep. John Emil List died in prison on March 21st, 2008, at the age of 82 due to complications from pneumonia. He died having served less than 2 decades of his life sentence, but his 18 years as a fugitive and the 1971 murders ensured his legacy as one of America's most chilling and methodical family annihilators. The story of John List is more than just a shocking murder case. It is a profound cautionary tale about the terrifying fragility of the American dream and the mask of morality. The tragedy of the List family was not a crime of sudden, uncontrollable rage. It was a cold, calculated execution born from a man's crippling fear of failure and his pathological need for control. List didn't kill his family out of hatred. He killed them out of a narcissistic, spiritual hubris, believing his financial and marital failure was so catastrophic that only he had the authority to determine the fate and salvation of his wife, mother, and 3 children. The nearly 2-decade manhunt became a defining moment in forensic science, proving that no matter how meticulous the planning, a criminal's physical self eventually betrays them. John List spent 18 years as Robert Clark, but he couldn't change the essence of John List, the rigid accountant, the devout churchgoer, the man of severe order. His very attempt to create his old life is what ultimately led to his downfall. And just 9 months after his escape, the magnificent Breezeknoll Mansion, which symbolized the List family's lost wealth and status, violently burned to the ground, as if the very structure rejected the evil that had stained it. The final irony lies in his own words. John List committed the ultimate act of violence, yet he clung to the belief that he was acting as a moral agent, saving his loved ones from disgrace. His crime was not only an annihilation of his family, but an annihilation of the very moral and religious principles that he claimed to uphold. The List murders remain a dark testament to what can hide behind a locked front door, a well-pressed suit, and a rigid religious fervor. It reminds us that sometimes the most dangerous people are not the strangers lurking in the shadows, but the figures standing stoically in the light of the morning. If you walk past 43 Hillside Avenue today, the original Breezeknoll is gone. It's rebuilt, renamed, and its past buried beneath new paint and manicured lawns. But the story lingers like a cold draft, a reminder that true horror doesn't always live in haunted houses or in ghost stories. Sometimes it sits across from you at the dinner table, bowing its head in prayer. And that concludes our look into the meticulous and deeply disturbing world of John List. The chilling efficiency of his crime and the audacity of his escape make this one of the most unforgettable cases in American true crime history.
It's a good one. It's a good episode.
Yeah.
It really is. I've seen it several times, you know, because I've seen it on repeat.
Right. I'm going to have to find it. I'm going to have to get on there and watch it.
You probably watch it on YouTube.
Probably. It might be on, because Forensic Files is on one of the streaming services that we have. I just can't remember which one. I just have to look and watch it.
But yeah, it's a good one. I like watching Forensic Files.
Yeah, me too.
And FBI Files.
Yeah.
And The New Detectives is another good one.
I haven't heard of that one.
It's like Forensic Files.
Oh.
But it's more up to date.
I like Unexplained Mysteries, the true crime ones.
Unsolved Mysteries?
Or yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, some of those are kind of weird.
Mm. You got anything else?
No.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning in for our first episode of November. We appreciate you guys sharing your time with us. Next week, next Monday, I'm not sure if it'll be Mandy or Mama. We'll just kind of see. Mandy's still dealing with, you know, everything from her dad passing away and all the stuff that comes with that being the oldest and all of that. So I'm not sure if she'll be back next week or not. So for now, Mama's kind of filling in whenever Mandy can't. Hopefully she'll be back soon though, because she's been gone for a few weeks.
And we miss her.
I know. So hopefully she'll be back next week, but I don't know. It's kind of up in the air still. So next week, whether it's whoever my co-host is, we are going to be moving from the quiet, calculated terror inside one home to a moment of instant shared national horror. We'll be covering a devastating event that occurred during a time when America was already at war, when thousands of families sought a brief, beautiful distraction. So make sure you join us next Monday as we explore a catastrophe that took place under the greatest show on earth, where a massive structure packed with mothers and children was consumed by a blinding inferno in less than 10 minutes.
Damn!
It is a story of criminal negligence, unprecedented speed, and the tragic of consequences that forever changed public safety in America.
Even if I co-host, y'all record where I can hear it.
It's a good one. It's crazy. So until then, give us a rate and a review, as always. Send us your emails. Check out our Facebook page. Both of those links are in the episode description. You can also find us on TikTok under Monstrous TC Pod. We will talk with y'all again on Monday and hope you have a great week. As always, we hope you keep listening and remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.